Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service. Catch all the hard-hitting news and current affairs that focuses on all relevant First Nations issues from a First Nations standpoint. This is Bo Spearham with Let's Talk.
Hello and welcome to Let's Talk.
Hello.
Before I go on any further, I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners on this land we are broadcasting from. I also like to pay my respects to our elders and also our elders of more recent arrival. And a big shout out to everybody from around the continent that is taking our program. Just remember, you can stream us via Spotify and Apple Podcast. You can also download our app at facebook.com.au. And you can listen to our website. You can listen via our website and listen to previous Let's Talk programs as a podcast on our website as well. On the program, I have a special show. I'll be speaking with a sister from Turtle Islands who is a journalist, or as they like to call themselves, storytellers, which I kind of like as well. And I think, that's what we are as Indigenous peoples in the media sector and just in general. We tell a mad yarn. We've always been, you know, storytellers. But this interview I recorded with Kelsey, First Nations woman from the west coast of so-called Canada. And we chat about some sensitive topics to her, residential schools, the 60 scoop, and also Cancel Canada and the toppling of statues as a part of the Canada Cancel Canada Day protest. And the reason why I'm chatting with her on the program is because the 9th of August is Global Indigenous Peoples Day by the UN. And I thought, why not whip around different parts of the world and chat to different Indigenous peoples? Sis, just before going further, could I get you to tell us your name, your mob, and where you're from?
Yeah, I'm Kelsey Kilana. I am a Selkishikwatmik storyteller from Turtle Island.
Deadly. Thank you. And what side of Canada are you on?
We're on the west, the interior of the west.
Awesome. So what's that? It's near Vancouver.
Yeah, we're about 4 hours inwards inland of Vancouver.
Awesome. Okay, thank you. I had the privilege back in 2014 to visit Turtle Island, and we drove myself and three other young Aboriginal people from the west coast to the east coast. A very beautiful country, just visiting different blockade camps, protest sites, and just sort of getting a feel for, the resistance movement over there as well. Very eye-opening, very welcoming. Really reminded me of back home, just how sort of listening to the stories, very, yes, very similar history. But then also the love and the openness as well that we got from Native mob over that way was something special. Definitely held that trip very, very close to me. You're a journalist for Indigenews. For our listeners, could you tell us a bit about the company you work for?
Yeah, so I am a storyteller for Indigenews, and we often talk about ourselves as storytellers. We are journalists at the heart of it, but we're storytellers first and foremost because it requires a much higher level of ethics and responsibility than journalism does. So it means that we're writing about our own people, and we follow our own storytelling laws before we follow Canadian press standards or ethics, which are often much lower than what ours are. And so it's a blend of that. And so we're community storytellers. We tell stories from the ground up. So instead of us being assigned a story, we're told a story by our communities, and then we share it. So that's what Indigenews is. It's we're kind of in the middle of a transitional phase right now where we are moving more into sort of refining our own practices. And so that goes everywhere from being trauma-informed storytellers to how do we, I guess, change the rest of the media landscape within so-called Canada.
I like that. I love that, you know, because I think that that's what, you know, Aboriginal people over here do, you know, especially when we're, you know, doing stories of trauma, you know, of immense trauma for families and communities, you know, like we're building relationships. You know, yes. It's not like we're just going to go in, hey, can I just get, you know, a 10-second grab from you to play on the news to, you know, just to show people what's happening. You know, it's about, you know, getting in there, talking about the issues, as well as creating a relationship and making, yes, you know, the community feel welcomed, you know, feel as if that they can come to us whenever they want to tell their story. You know, because at the end of the day, you know, we're just sort of transferring or amplifying, you know, their voices, you know, of their respected sort of issues and stories that they want to tell us as well. Like, yeah, I loved everything you said in terms of, you know, the lens that we, you know, and what I mean we, like we as sort of Indigenous people look at when we want to be honest and be truthful and sort of share, you know, are those stories as well. I've been following it for a bit as well because our mutual friend Shahela sort of linked us up, but also, you know, she's very heavy on social media. She shared, she would always share her stories and the stories of you guys as well. So I'll definitely be, sharing it more as well on my platforms. But I wanted to talk to you on the program this morning about, a multitude of issues that happened over there, over there as well. And, you know, I guess the first one, you know, is sort of one that's been heavily in the media, not just in Canada, but, you know, it's made world news. Especially when this story first came out and it was finding the remains of young children who were in residential schools. And I just do really urge any listeners, if they do feel triggered, you know, please, you know, call your local Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Medical Service, you know, if this is triggering, or call, you know, the respected helplines that you call as well, because we will be mentioning and talking about some horrific and things on the program as well. And we'll do our best to be sensitive as well. Sorry about this, but yeah, could you tell us a bit about how this sort of transpired, the finding of remains?
Yeah. Thank you for that trigger warning. It is really important and needs to happen a lot more than it does. So thank you. For me personally, my family actually all went to the Kamloops so-called Indian residential school. And so it was very personal when it first hit the news, and it was the Kamloops Tishiquatmiq school that was, the first one to release a number, and it's not a full number. That number comes from only 2 acres of land, and they have so much more land to be looking at. That is just one small fraction. So the number is going to grow, and for myself, it was extremely traumatizing. And I said, like, when that news hit, it felt like I'll never be the same person again, because of the stories that we've heard. I spent the past 15 years working with survivors of the residential schools, and I have heard all the stories of how these bodies have gotten there. I've heard the stories of you know, the people, the folks that I was working with having to dig a lot of those graves on their own as children, and of all of the escapees that tried to go home and were brought back or were not brought back ever. So it's been so traumatizing. At the same time, it's also been such a moment of truth for this country. This country now knows where that they have benefited from these deaths, that these deaths is something that they built this country on, our so-called country. And this is who they are. And that's a big, big awakening for a lot of people.
Definitely.
And
If I could sort of jump in, you know, for our listeners and for a lot of our non-Indigenous listeners that are tuning in, residential schools are in a way the same things as dormitories and boarding schools here, where they were a part of the stolen generation when Aboriginal children were taken from their families and taken to these different institutions. You know, usually over here what would happen is they would get maybe a grade 3 to 4 education, or maybe even lower. And then when they sort of got to an early age to be, you know, forcibly adopted or stationed, you know, the women would learn how to be maids and domestic hands, and the men would learn from a young age to be cattle workers and work on stations as drovers and all these different things. You know, I just sort of wanted to give that kind of idea and perspective of here, because, you know, we're still going through this process of people understanding the trauma and the impact that, you know, our elders had in these institutions, because these institutions laid the platform for assimilation. They laid the platform for the shame and the breaking, you know, of sadly of some of our people's spirits and that as well. And, you know, just as you mentioned, you know, families running away, same thing here. You know, there's a famous story of which got immortalized in a movie called Rabbit Proof Fence, where, you know, two young sisters and a cousin ran away from their boarding school, the dormitory that they were staying in, and returned home, and it got made into a film called Rabbit Proof Fence. And I just wanted to draw that comparison in terms of how, you know, the British, or just sort of how colonial powers would come in and, you know, steal our babies and our families, and it just wasn't a process of them, you know, taking them and them sort of getting some sort of education, and then going in and being a part of this the establishment of the society. It was, you know, the total opposite, because they're, you know, exploiting our people, you know, through slavery and you know, as we're seeing and at the moment in your country. You know, we're finding we're hearing these stories of remains. I did want to ask a question as well. You know, you mentioned that is very triggering and traumatizing, doing these stories, especially knowing that, you know, you had relatives and family members that attended that. You know, how did you approach sort of writing and telling this story?
Yeah, I actually, I took to social media immediately, to Twitter, to just basically plead with the media to not even touch these stories until we have developed a really clear and good way about going about these kinds of stories. And here in so-called Canada, a lot of the journalism schooling is, so when they do their training, it's really surrounded by how you as a journalist can protect yourself from other people's stories, which honestly gives you a shield so that you can further extract. And to me, that's wrong. Like, yes, you need to protect your heart in a good way, but if you need to protect your heart so much, then don't do that story, because you're actually traumatizing people who live without those same tools. And so I immediately actually started writing a trauma-informed guide for reporting on Indigenous trauma, because it impacted my family right away. My grandfather, who went there for 10 years, he heard the news and he was by himself, and he had to lock his doors, and he went into complete trauma response. And I keep telling people, this is life and death. Like, we're not talking about just going to extract your story. We're talking about you've triggered somebody, and in their body, they are now completely feeling all of those traumas that they experienced in the schools. And so it's to be very mindful and careful with your heart on how, or with others' hearts on how you carry their heavy stories. So that's what I did right away, as I just took to social media and said, these are not your communities. And so it is one thing to believe that you're privileged enough to go knock on the doors of our people who've suffered this. but it is quite another to bring down the rest of us and bring down where, you know, our ability to survive and thrive, and to keep painting that picture that we're weak, traumatized people, when really we're beautiful people who are completely made of strength that, that have survived all of these things and are continuing to still raise our children up in a good way, in a traditional way, and to fight all of these negative ideologies that they're painting of us. And again, to further create division amongst the societies. So it was like, it was really critical for me to take to social media right away, and then to also begin writing this trauma-informed guide. And this guide is like, has put me into a depression, because like an actual depression, only because I feel like I'm pleading with media, with mainstream media, to treat us as human beings. And I feel like in 2021, this shouldn't even, I shouldn't have to tell people to not hurt us. Like, it's just unreal to me that this even needs to happen. And that, you know, as this news came out, we've seen suicides happening. We've seen communities going into a state of emergency because of suicide. And we've seen communities and people who have been dry, walking the red road, sober for a long time, turn back to alcoholism or turn back to drug use to cope with all of this. So it's really, really serious. And it's a very severe situation that that's happening right now. And all we're asking for is empathy. And that's honestly not what we're getting a lot of. We do in a sense, but I don't want to give too much credit to Canadians, I guess, when there's still so much work to be done. And they're just, the fact that they're not continuing to hurt us, for me, is not a reason to celebrate.
Definitely.
And
you're listening to Let's Talk on 98.9 FM. My guest on the program is Kelsey Kilana, editor and storyteller from Indigenews. It's a First Nations news outlet in Canada, and she's joining us all the way from the west coast of Canada in Turtle Island, and we're yarning about the 60 Scoop, missing and murdered Indigenous women, the finding of the remains of young Indigenous children, and also Cancel Canada Day. You know, you raised some amazing points just then as well. One was sort of, you know, like, it's just, yeah, you know, like, we see our communities, you know, get to a point of maybe self-reflection, and then, you know, these things happen where, you know, the media will just come out and write, you know, do no justice to sort of a certain story, you know, and the big effect on that as well, you know. And just as you mentioned, you know, like, you know, suiciding and you know, mob sort of falling back, you know, to drugs and alcohol as well. Like, that should be an indicator in terms of how messed up, you know, these institutions were to those generations of people who were forced, you know, to go there as well. And, you know, it's still that whole, you know, like, telling the story of, you know, the native without sort of understanding the impact and looking like you're doing something good, you know, about that, and, you know, completely missing, you know, the issue at hand as well. Like, last year at the height of the Black Lives Matter protest, there was, I don't know if you saw it, but there was an Australian journalist, I think she was in like LA, and there was some protesting happening, and this black, this white journalist, Aussie, you know, blonde hair, blue eyes, you know, the typical sort of, you know, you know, the pinup of what Australia is supposed to look like. You know, she went up to like this, you know, this black mob, you know, protesting over there, and she goes, because they told her, you know, stop recording, go away, because, you know, they don't understand what's going on. And she goes, oh, you know, sorry about that. You know, I just wanted to get your point of view because, you know, back home in Australia, you know, these things don't happen. We don't have police brutality. I'm trying to paraphrase what you're saying. And, you know, immediately, you know, Aboriginal journalist you know, families of loved ones who have died in police custody or in prison immediately sort of took to Twitter and social media and corrected this individual. And then as that process kept going on, she just kept blocking, you know, individuals and you know, Indigenous journalists and stuff on Twitter and stuff as well. And, you know, like, yeah, they're like, yeah, so sometimes they just completely miss the mark as well. How has, you know, the community, you know, sort of gathered around this particular issue at the moment, you know? Yeah, you know, what is the response from sort of the broader, you know, Native community back back where you are?
Yeah, we like quickly everybody mobilized to go into ceremony, and that's what I think is so beautiful, is that no matter what has happened, we have our ceremonies behind us that guide us through all of this. So there is no question on what we should be doing or how to interact with our grief and how to be in kinship with our grief. We know exactly how to do that, and we know we do it immediately. So what happened right away was the next day a sacred fire was lit, and those fires go for 4 days. And that's kind of what I put on Indigenous' social media right away, was saying, we're not going to be talking about this or conducting any type of business that has to do with this so-called discovery. But for us, it's a knowing. We're not going to be talking about it until the sacred fire is out, because we don't conduct business in grief. And so that's what we did, is we all turned to our grief protocol right away, which tells us that we're there to be with each other. We're there to discuss and to do business around the discovery and how we're going to move forward together as a people. And also sharing stories at that time, crying at that time, mourning. And now that this has kind of come out, we know that we're in deep grief and mourning for the next year. So for the next year, we're going to follow our protocols, and we're going to be in mourning, and we're not going to take up additional ceremonies. We're not going to go gathering on the land or to do all of these things that we're supposed to be doing, because it's our time to take care of our spirits right now. So that was the most beautiful thing, is that we knew what to turn to. And it felt like even in the midst of this genocide and of them trying to kill us off from who we are, we stopped and we went into ceremony right away. And it was an act of love and resistance, I feel like, that we turned in and we were like, no, we're not going to start, you know, being angry. We never moved into anger and still have not moved into anger. We've all kept our peace in our heart, and we all went right into ceremony and dealt with our pain and trauma together. And we've seen a really beautiful outpouring of love and support from Canadians and from other communities. Like, the Sikh community has been standing beside us this entire time. They have not left our side. It's been just a really beautiful coming together of any, you know, Black or people of color communities. So that's what I find has been really amazing. And it's kind of like you do see a division, in a sense. You see a division of the people who are so hardened to be like fanatical about Canada, which is so odd. It's a really odd thing, because in our own teachings, we don't praise or we don't hold a political identity as being a part of our identity. We don't hold that close to us. Whereas those Canadians that do, those are the ones that are problematic in all of this. When it came to Cancel Canada Day, that didn't happen in my own town. And I live only 40 minutes away from the so-called school. And our politicians here put out a very public statement that now is not the time to be talking about it. When it's Canada Day, we talk about Canada and we celebrate this great country. And that is, I think, Cancel Canada Day was actually one of the biggest markers that showed us who is who in all of this, who are our actual allies and who are those that will continue to stand on genocide as being part of their identity that they're proud of. It was very telling.
If I can just quickly say, my guest this morning is Kelsey Kilana from Indigenous in Turtle Island in Canada. She's joining us all the way from the west coast of Canada, and we're chatting about residential schools, 60 Scoops, 60 Scoop, Cancel Canada Day, and the finding of Indigenous children's remains at residential schools. I want to sort of talk about maybe in this section, missing and murdered Indigenous women, if that's okay. I know that's a massive, a huge issue as well as in Canada and the United States. You know, I remember when we were driving, you know, and we were through Canada, and nearly, you know, mostly all the places we stopped, like the truck stops and the fuel stations, there would be a picture of somebody missing. You know, how huge of an issue is missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls?
It's monumental. It is huge. And so that's what I think was another big thing coming off of the 215. My short term, I guess, for the so-called residential school findings is 215, because that's the first number of children that were, I don't want to say uncovered, but were, you know, they were finally put into the public, that number. But that started a whole movement of missing and murdered Indigenous children, because, and that is what broke me, is I've lived so long with MMIW G2S, which is Missing, Murdered, Indigenous Women, Girls, and Two-Spirit. With that, you know, that movement, to now we have MMIWC, Missing and Murdered, or MMIC, Missing and Murdered Indigenous Children, which is absolutely, I hate that we have to have a movement for our children. So MMIW G2S, it's a huge movement, and you'll be hard pressed to find any Indigenous person that doesn't know of someone who's either missing or has been murdered. And for myself, people always look at me as just your typical person, but my family has been so gravely impacted by the so-called residential schools, by the 60 Scoop, by the MMIW G2S movement. And so my grandmother is a part of that movement. My nephew's grandmother is currently missing right now. She's been missing now for 5 years. And my great grandmother, my great great grandmother was also murdered. And so it's a huge movement. It's a mass genocide of our women, because they know that when they break our women down, what happens is they kill the life force inside of us. They kill that. And then they also, that's how they antagonize our warriors, our men. They antagonize the men by killing the women and then imprisoning them when they try to, when they react to that loss. And so it's a huge tool of genocide. And it's been one that has been effective in the sense that we have had to grow up without mothers. We have a lot of motherless people. I grew up without a mother because my mother was a 60 Scoop baby. That means that she was taken by, so after residential schools, they came out with day schools. And then after day schools, like you were saying, that forced adoption. So they did the same thing. That's what we call the 60 Scoop, was a mass forced adoption. She was put into the foster care system and was shipped all around the United States and Canada, and then finally went on to have her own children at a young age, and discovering, because she grew up without a mother, her mother grew up without a mother, all of these different acts and tools of genocide were just imposed on my family. So I didn't have a mother. So now I'm the first generation to be raising a child, to be raising my children. I'm the first woman in my family to be raising my children. And I'm only 34 years old. So that is, you know, that goes to show just how big this movement is. It's continuing. There's a very big lack of care when it comes to investigating, and when it comes to the justice system. It's all, I don't ever want to call it broken. It's not broken. None of it's broken. It's all just doing exactly as it was designed to do, and that is to ignore us in our lives. And I think that a lot of times media has done a really good job of ignoring that because they can't prove it. Also, just because it does play into to who they are fundamentally, but it's just been hidden all this time, I guess. And all of this truth is now coming out to our trauma. People are really opening their eyes to understand that this is not intergenerational trauma. This is generational. It goes and it goes and it goes. And the continuation of killing our women, they do try to put that on us, right? That, well, you guys are doing it to yourself. You're putting yourself in these positions. It's not just us. They do continue to kill us by not investigating our deaths, to not investigating when we go missing. And so a lot of times we do have to put out these posts on social media. People may have seen them saying, if I go missing, please know that it wasn't my choice. Because I just searched for my cousin 2 weeks ago, and the police told us that she likely wants to be missing, so they won't be putting any resources into looking for her. And so we actually have to make public statements to say that we don't want to go missing. So if we do, please look for us. And that's just the reality of it. We all live with it every day. My daughter's not allowed to walk around at all by herself. We do have known murderers living in our communities who have taken our women, who have been to court a million times, but because they're white, they get off all the time. And so we have to really take care of ourselves. And it does create a massive division between us and the rest of the Canadian society, because they're not doing anything about it. That's not our government to be fighting. We're sovereigns. That's actually not even our government. So that's what makes it a genocide, is that we as Indigenous sovereign people are fighting a whole other government to stay alive. So that's where, you know, it becomes an international issue.
Telehealth is here to stay. With telehealth, you can still join your medical appointments from the comfort of your own home, either over the phone or via video call. All you need is an internet-enabled device, like a smartphone or laptop. You can ask your clinic for help. Telehealth saves you time, as you don't need to bring the whole family to the clinic, arrange transport, or wait in the waiting room. You just need to find a quiet and safe space to have your appointment. To find out if your next appointment can be done via telehealth, ask the receptionist the next time you book an appointment. To find your nearest clinic, visit www.iuih.org.au/findaclinic.
A message from the Institute of Urban Indigenous Health.
Station sponsor.
If I can just quickly say, my guest this morning is Kelsey Kilana from Indigenous in Turtle Island in Canada. She's joining us all the way from the west coast of Canada, and we're chatting about residential schools, 60 Scoops, 60 Scoop, Cancel Canada Day, and the finding of Indigenous children's remains at residential schools. You're just listening, it sounds so familiar and just correlates with so many different times and sort of different incidents that happen here. You know, just recently, you know, the community, you know, where my dad comes from, called Maury, there was a young 22-year-old man, Aboriginal man from my tribe. He hasn't been seen for 3 weeks now, 4 weeks now. He was last seen on dash cam, I believe it was like police dash cam footage, being chased towards a river. Now, as soon as the families heard about it, they automatically went to the river, done searching, you know, police and the SES. They helped search for like a couple of days, then they stopped searching. The community, they were just, you know, searching on their own without equipment. They had a protest in the town, you know, then the police put out a statement saying, you know, they're going to put resources in and continue searching with the community and all these different things. And yeah, you know, there's another story that I want to mention as well. These three, I believe they were Gambangi children from a community called Barraville. I think there were two siblings and a cousin, I believe. They're known as the Barraville murders. And What happened was, they went missing. I believe they found some of their clothes or something. And for years, the family have been, fighting for justice, to the point where, as you just mentioned just then, like they knew who the person was and the person lived in the community and nothing else is happening. There's an amazing journalist by the name of Alan Clark. He's been following the story for over 10 years, and every sort of different news outlet that he went to, he done projects on this to keep this in the forefront of people's minds and sort of in media. And he's actually bringing out a doco soon, so when that comes out, I'll definitely send you a link as well. And it's crazy that in the day and age that we're in, we can sit from totally two different continents and sort of talk about stories and issues that correlate, that mirror sort of our experiences as Indigenous peoples as well. And this sort of last part that I want to talk about, Cancel Canada Day, you mentioned it just before as well. On the 26th of January here every year, we've protested against Australia Day, the celebration, the landing of the first fleet, the setup of the British first settlement here in Australia. Since 1938, it's been an active and known day for Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people from around the country to protest against this. In the last 10 years, it's become sort of, front page or media where tens of thousands of people in each sort of state and territories are come to these these protests. Mind you, anything else that happens, to our mob throughout the year, we don't get those numbers, but because there's sort of a, an understanding or a shift or whatever it is, people feel as if, that's sort of the issue that they want to more protest than come to us when, our family die in custody and our communities die in custody or our children still get taken at a high rate. I'd love to sort of get the understanding on Cancel Canada Day, where it came from and when that actual day is.
Yeah, so Cancel Canada Day is on so-called Canada Day, which is July 1st here. And it is a day that was set up basically this year. There have been other years where we talk about it, but it had become so important for us to do that this year. And there was events put on all across the country throughout different towns. Some townships actually would put it on themselves, which was it's a huge statement. And it just goes to show, I guess, that the future, like once the racists kind of like move their way through this life, we do have a really bright future, because it's a lot of young people that are sort of coming to the forefront of this issue and saying like, we're not going to be celebrating genocide, because that's what it is. It's a celebration of genocide. I'm a younger parent and my children are teenagers, but I raised them up and I told them in school that you don't stand for the Canadian anthem. Like, yes, you're going to get dirty looks. Yes, people will be upset with you, but that's someone else's war song. That's their honor song. And we have our own war songs and our own honor songs to sing. We don't need to stand for theirs. And that's just what it is we have to live in direct adversity all the time. And it's Cancel Canada Day just sort of carries that energy in one day, like you were saying. Like, it's that one time where everybody comes together and is like, has this understanding that we're just letting you know that we're not tolerating it anymore. Because for us as Indigenous people, and again, as sovereigns, it really changes things when people could understand that we're sovereign, that we're not actually Canadians, that they're a neighbor to us. Their law is not supposed to be imposed on us whatsoever. We have our own laws, and it's not that we were conquered or we had signed any agreement or that we had surrendered anything. We never surrendered. And that's very clear. through our own oral histories and teachings. And so for us, it's a day of celebrating our sovereignty. And also just saying, like, we reject all of Canada. We reject all of those laws that they've imposed upon us to contribute to genocide all of these years. And so when they had the 150-year celebration a few years ago, Vancouver was one of the first to step up and say, we're going to have a 150-plus celebration. So for the whole week before Canada Day happened, they had a whole week of Indigenous, just like Indigenous, like activities and events going on, anything to really share about the people of the land. And so there is movement in a positive way towards understanding what that means. And it's just a day of us being able to share from our hearts what it means and what it feels like to have Canadians celebrate our genocide, because that's truly what it is. That is at the core of it, what it is. They are celebrating our genocide. And that's a slap in the face when we talk about how many of our people that's killed and continues to kill so that they can live in comfort and they can live the life that they live on the bones of our children and the blood of our women.
I was just listening and, you know, over here, you know, lots of Aboriginal families, they encourage their kids. You know, my parents encouraged, you know, me and my siblings not to sing the national anthem, not to stand for it as well. You know, we, at the highest level of one of our national sporting codes, you know, some of the best players in the national rugby league competition won't sing the national anthem, and they came out publicly, you know, stating it's not our song. You know, the song, yes, you know, is incorrect in its interpretation of, you know, history in this country. We're not young, we're not free. I just started laughing when you were mentioning that as well. And because I can just hear other mobs saying, yeah, no, that's what we do as well.
Yes.
You know, and over here, you know, over the last couple of years, there's been this narrative of change the date. Celebrate, you know, Australia Day on another day. And then there's been this other one, you know, that I'm personally for as well, which is just abolish Australia Day. You know, like, is there, you know, like, how can we, you know, change the date of celebrating something when, you know, every day, you know, every, you know, 365 days of a year, something bad has happened, you know, to our, yes, mob. You know, let's sort of move forward first and think about, you know, what has happened, what is happening, as you mentioned. Yeah, and then also there's this narrative every year, like with Invasion Day, it's like a whole month. Like, it's a one-day event that happens, but it's like a month process for a lot of us who are very active on the day or just active online on social media. You know, there's obviously the narrative from, you know, the broader public, which is, oh, just get over it, you know, like, or it's I didn't do that, you know, I'm not my ancestors, yeah, who did the bad thing. You know, then there's us on the other hand, who was like, well, how can we get over it? How can we stop, you know, having these emotions when, you know, these things want to continue to happen? But, you know, every monument that we go past, every statue that we go past, every bridge that we walk over, every park that we play in with our kids is named after sort of one of these generals or one of these colonial powers who inflicted, you know, some horrific policy or act upon us. You know, we're living and breathing, you know, this process every single day. It's in our face. We can't get over it. You know, what are we supposed to do, you know, when you say these things? You know, is that sort of the same thing as well in and around sort of Canada Day? Like, there's, you know, over here it's just a massive debate. You know, some mob, they just like stay off Facebook. We have a thing over here with social media is you never read the comments, you know, because the comments are always racist. You know what I mean? Like, without a doubt, you know, even if it's a good article, you know, talking about, you know, the history or whatever, there's always going to be trolls on there sort of writing disgusting, you know, racist stuff about our mob as well. So, you know, we have a thing where you don't read the comments, you know, it's, you know, and, like, these fellows get like really hurt too, you know what I mean, when we tell them, you know, the true facts of what is happening or what happened as well. But yeah, one thing that I thought was really cool as well with the Cancel Canada Day, and we'll wrap up after this as well, Kelsey, is that there was the toppling of statues. You know, we saw last year the toppling of statues at the height of the Black Lives Matter protest globally. And then, you know, I think there was a couple throughout the Cancel Canada Day events as well.
Yes, yeah, and churches burned.
That's right, yes, yes, yeah. And was that in a response to the residential schools?
Yes, yeah, that was. And there's such mixed emotions about the churches, but to me, the church is the biggest monument that can be taken down. And there's a lot of, because different teachings come through different nations. So all of our territories have different teachings. So for some of them, that's how they respond. And that's a good thing. For other nations, they actually, it's, they kind of get ashamed, I guess, of those kind of activities. Mostly because they just don't want to sink to the level of a Canadian. And that's kind of what it is it's more that we will always, no matter what, have the strength of our spirit, and we don't need to do those kind of actions. However, we are seeing so much more with younger generations for them, it's a statement. It is like, you know, you will not build your golden statue of our colonizer so that I have to walk past it every single day. And for them, that's a very like power to the people kind of move, which is totally for each person to decide on their own how they feel about that. But it's, yeah, I would say it's a big movement. It's a big thing that's happening. We've seen so many mixed emotions over it. Again, because our integrity, it's the integrity of the people. So when one person takes part in that, they understand that they are carrying the teachings of their people when they do those things. For me personally, speaking for myself, I carry no attachment to churches. I carry no attachment to any statues or anything like that, because people are like, well, we have, you know, memories with our grandmothers in the church because they were successfully colonized. And so, you know, we have memories there, but for me, those aren't the memories that I care to, embody inside of a church. I have memories with my grandmother at the kitchen table too. I have memories in her home too. I have memories on the land with her too. It doesn't need to be memorialized inside of a church. And so there's just so many different emotions and reactions to those kinds of behaviors. And for me personally, I think it is because I'm younger. I am more of the mindset of, we don't need these things here to remind us. That it's a symbolic gesture of like, let's honestly tear it down. And that's what I say about media and anything really. I'm like, let's just dismantle the F out of it all. Like, yeah, let's dismantle it all, because we're done now. We're done with those old ways, those old ways of thinking of colonizing. If we're saying that we're a progressive country, then let's actually progress instead of just, you know, talking about it. We really need to be about it and have these conversations and face the truth, face what's happened, dismantle it and build something new. It's, and not new in a way that forgets us and forgets our role here, which is a big movement with Land Back. And that's a huge movement I've been talking a lot about through my journalism, is Land Back. And it's that time now. So it's time to dismantle Canada Day, dismantle Canada, and give land back, give agency back to Indigenous peoples, give us back our sovereignty, give us back our rights to run this land the way we used to, because that's what's killing us now. That's why we have fires. That's why we have droughts. It's because capitalism and colonialism has reared its ugly head over this country and has failed us miserably over and over and continue to. And the only way to not solve, but to come to a resolve of some sort, any of this, is to give us our land back or to give us resources so that we can begin to reclaim who we are too as Indigenous people.
Well, I guess on that note, Kelsey, I want to say thank you for coming on the program and having a chat are with me as well. Very insightful, very powerful as well. I'd love to invite you back on the program to have more yarns, you know, just to sort of let us know what's happening over there as well. Just really quickly, where can people find Indigenous? What platforms and what's the website?
Yeah, so our website is www.indigenews.com. And then you can follow us on all platforms. We're on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, all by just Indigenews.
Awesome. Can you just stay on the line too, sis? I just want to have a yarn with you when we're off air as well. Just for our listeners, Kelsey is joining us from the west coast of Canada, so-called Canada Turtle Islands, and she's from Indigenous. I do urge people out there to go check out that platform, the website, on social media as well. Share the stories as well. And even if there's any black journalists out there that want to sort of, you know, hopefully write some stories, is open to sort of Indigenous mob from over here writing stories?
Yes, we would love that. We would absolutely love to have any Indigenous journalist, black journalist, to either collaborate with us on some stories or to just feel free to write with us. Absolutely.
Deadly. For my listeners, you can catch the podcast of this program on our website at 989fm.com.au. You can also check out previous Let's Talk programs. And as always, it's a pleasure. You've been listening to Let's Talk here on Murray Country, 989FM.